Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable. Today, we're going to talk about coverage of the latest developments related to the Middle East, from the civil wars and a humanitarian crisis in Yemen to the shifting roles of outside powers like the U.S., Russia, and Russia in Syria, from Palestinian protests at the border between Gaza and Israel and the deadly Israeli military response to the visit of Saudi Prince Mohammed bin Salman to the United States. In this part of the world, context and depth of knowledge are critical. Fortunately, on today's program, we have two great journalists with decades of experience covering the region between them. Martin Smith is the first of them. His most recent documentary for Frontline is called Bitter Rivals, Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's two really remarkable hours about the conflict between these two nations that for the past 40 years has shaped the Middle East and had a devastating impact on so many people there. Martin, thank you for your great reporting on that series. I want to make sure people know they can still see it on the Frontline website, and there's a link from yourcallradio.org as well. But a great honor to have you with us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Also with us is another Martin, making for a three-Martin program, Martin Chuloff, who is a regular guest on this program. He covers the Middle East for The Guardian, won the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2015, and he has reported from the Middle East since 2005, and right now he is in Beirut. Martin, thanks so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure.
So let's start today's program, as we always do, by asking each of you to talk about a piece of reporting from this week that you thought was particularly impressive, that you thought people should know about so they could go check it out for themselves. Martin Chuloff, let's start with you.
Well, I thought the Dexter Filkins piece in the New Yorker this week, the profile of Mohammed bin Salman, the young Saudi crown prince who was on the forefront of people's tongues these days. How's he been progressing? How did he rise? What's on his agenda? I thought it was a fantastic deep dive. It was obviously richly reported over many months. Had a lot of access to people who hadn't spoken before, and some genuine insights into the man and his character, and some formative years, which I think will stand the test of time as a seminal piece of work, as MBS, as they call them, as his legacy is examined over the years and probably over the decades.
We're definitely going to talk more about his visit to the U.S. that's been ongoing this week later in the program and how it's been covered. But when you're talking about insights about who the prince is, share something with us. Give us a sense of what we'll get reading Dexter Filkins' story.
The King Salman, who is the King of Saudi Arabia now, he has dozens of sons. Mohammed bin Salman was his favorite, and there was a couple of vignettes in that story which indicated that at an early age he was spotted as being somebody that the king saw as having more ability than his siblings. He was busy taking notes at all his father's speeches. He had a panache and a charisma to him. The father was introducing him as my son at every meeting with U.S. officials that he had. He was clearly proud. He gave him very good access to the royal court and to decision-making, and he was groomed for the role that he is now playing for many years. And the other thing that was interesting is just the scheming and the maneuvering that went on between 2016 and I think it was May or June last year when he finally toppled his cousin, Mohammed bin Nayef. I mean, that was genuinely a royal coup. And just the machinations behind that, I just found very instructive.
That's Dexter Filkins' latest piece in The New Yorker, A Saudi Prince's Quest to Remake the Middle East. We'll put a link to that at our website, yourcallradio.org. Martin Smith, tell us about a piece of journalism that you were impressed by this week.
I don't know about this week. I want to talk about ongoing coverage, in-depth coverage. I will agree with Martin that Dexter's piece on MBS is an excellent piece of work, and agree that it is full of insights and will stand the test of time. But I want to talk about the work of two journalists that have contributed to our understanding and coverage of an largely uncovered war in Yemen, and that is a BBC journalist, Nawal Al-Maghafi, who has done work over the last couple of years since 2011. She's a Yemeni Brit who, after the Arab Spring uprising took place in Yemen, she went to the country and on her own began to cover it, was noticed by the BBC, and since then has been doing reporting on it consistently, very in-depth, and bringing new insights into what's going on there. I will also say a colleague of mine at Frontline, Safa Al-Ahmed, who has done excellent work and has just come out of Yemen and is preparing another frontline follow-up to her work there. This is a place that is largely been difficult for journalists to cover, and so I applaud the work of those two women in covering it.
Well, you spent time reporting in Yemen this past year. Give us a sense of just how difficult that is, and for a journalist.
We were the only American team to be able to get access to the Houthi-controlled north of Yemen last year, and it is quite a feat, and one has to get permission to fly in on the UN flights, which are only allowed to fly in when the Saudis, who control the airspace because they're executing a major bombing campaign and have been for several years, only when the Saudis clear the airspace can you get in, and so they're very tight in who they let get on those planes. And we were able to, with persistence and a lot of waiting time in Djibouti across the waterway there, get on that flight and get in and cover it. Once you get in there, you're watched closely by the Houthis, but one can see quite a bit. We spent 2 or 3 weeks on the ground, and it was part of our Bitter Rivals report as we looked at the various wars around the region that are being fed by the Saudis or the Iranians. Yemen was an important piece of that.
Yeah, that's Martin Smith with Frontline. Also with us, Martin Chuloff of The Guardian. And Martin Smith there giving some kudos to Nawal Amagafi of the BBC and Frontline Safa Al-Ahmed. We will put links to their reporting at our website, yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the weekly media roundtable where we talk about major stories of the week and talking about wars that have certainly involved that rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran that you covered in depth in this documentary for Frontline, Martin. Of course, the war in Syria has really just ripped a hole in the region in so many ways. And so let's start by talking about President Trump's unscripted remarks a few days ago when he said he wanted to get out of the war there and pull the U.S. military back. I'd start with you, Martin Chuloff. Just how do you assess the seriousness of anything that comes out of President Trump's mouth, especially given the pushback that he's gotten from his military and diplomatic advisors?
Yeah, that's the operative question, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, though, he is the president of the United States. He is the commander in chief of the U.S. military, and he is a guy that's pretty used to getting his way. So, despite the fact that he has the National Security Committee in the White House there, he has the Pentagon, he has the State Department, all pushing back, saying withdrawing from Syria now would be catastrophic. You know, it would undermine any legacy that the U.S. has so far there, to the extent that it has one. Despite that, he still seems intent on pulling back to this user-pays model and trying to force others in the region to pay their way. Now, a simple assessment of what's on the ground at the moment is you have a rump of around 2,200 Islamic State fighters along the Euphrates River Valley. They're well dug in, they're embedded, and nobody's going after them, especially the Americans. And the main reason is, over the last couple of months, their partners in the northeast of Syria, the Kurdish forces that they allied with, have been diverted to the northwest of Syria, where the Turks have attacked a former stronghold of theirs called Afrin. Now, the Kurds, who were heavily backed in the northeast, were left alone by the Americans in the northwest. And even before the Trump proclamation that he wants the American forces out of there, the relationship between the U.S. forces and their Kurdish allies had started to splinter. I would have thought that the reckoning that the Kurds will make now is that the U.S. are not going to be reliable long-term partners. So if that is the reckoning, and I'm told it is by people inside the province there, then what does that mean for the fight against ISIS? And what does that mean for the northeast of Syria, even when the Americans leave? Is it yet another vacuum in the Syrian civil war, which other partners, Russia or other contemporaries or other protagonists, whatever you'd like to call them, Russia and Iran, would actually step into that vacuum? And what would that mean for regional security? So no matter which way you look at this, the Trump pronouncement is going to lead to further destabilization. It's not going to lead to anything good.
Does it basically tilt things toward the Assad regime in terms of where this conflict might go?
I think the Kurds of the northeast, their only play now, rather than continue to ally with the U.S. and bank on their word that they're staying for the long term, their only play is to re-ally with the Syrian regime. At the moment, they're not completely hostile to the Syrian regime, but they've been trying to use the chaos of war to stake out their own claim, whether that be decentralization, whether that be a form of federalism, or whether it be the grand prize, autonomy. Autonomy doesn't seem to be in the mix, but any of the other two do. And if the Americans can't help deliver that, then they'll ally with the regime. The Turks will be happy with that, and so will the Russians. So, I see an alliance of Russia, Turkey, and the Kurds going forward with the Americans, no matter what happens with Trump's next proclamation, being left out.
But meanwhile, at the same time that Trump was making these remarks, Vladimir Putin is arriving in Turkey to talk with President Rouhani of Iran, President Erdogan of Turkey, about what they might want or how they might cooperate or avoid conflict in certain ways in Syria. So what does that mean for the Kurds, and why do you think they're making common cause now? And maybe I'll turn that to Martin Smith, since you've obviously followed the conflict there quite closely.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the beginning of this fight against ISIS, the Kurds have thrown themselves into battle. It was the Battle of Kobani early on in the fight on the border of Turkey inside Syria. That impressed the Americans that the Kurds really were a good partner, and they signed up with them, and they became their chief ally. But from the beginning, I think the Kurds had to have known that getting some good deal out of this in the long run was not a great bet. I remember sitting down with Brett McGurk, who ran the operation for the State Department, the war against ISIS for the State Department, and I said, what are the Kurds going to get out of this in the end? And he just didn't want to go there. It was a question that that he ducked. So I don't know if the pushback that the president is getting for his proclamation that we're pulling out of there is going to mean that in fact we do stay. It's a little unclear. I mean, he has a way of saying one thing that his supporters like to hear, and quietly allowing the policy to remain in effect. In other words, that the military will get its wish, which is that they stay and finish the job, as they say. Even then, I'm not sure the war against ISIS will be over. They'll melt back into the desert as they were after, before 2011, when the U.S. pulled out of Iraq, and they'll operate as a guerrilla as a guerrilla force, as they did. So, but on the Kurdish question, the Kurds have been betrayed many times. They certainly can't be surprised if it happens again.
And Martin Chulov, what do you think that Erdogan and Rouhani and Putin are talking about?
All three have had a more or less an alliance of convenience for going on 2 years now. I think it was April 2016 where Turkey and Russia got back together. About, I think it was 6 months earlier, the Turks shut down a Russian jet over northern Syria. But it was actually the question of the Kurds that brought Ankara and Moscow together. Moscow had understood that to Turkey, the Kurdish issue was far more important than anything else, including ISIS. There's been a gap along the 500-mile border. It's roughly 60 miles long. It's between the Euphrates River, which is top central in the country, and Afrin, which is the town I mentioned earlier, in the northwest. That is the only part, or it was the only part of the border, in which the Kurds didn't have a significant presence. And it's been important to Erdogan that not only stays that way, but that gap widens. And Russia was able to, or they chose to give the Turkish Air Force cover in the bombing campaign in Afrin. And what we will see now in coming months, I would imagine, is an attritional change in the demography in the northwest, which we'll see Kurds that the Turks weren't happy with being shipped out elsewhere. Some Arabs gradually moving in, and perhaps a minority Kurdish population that isn't allied to the YPG or PKK. So at the end of the day, the alliance between Moscow and Ankara is getting stronger based on that question of the Kurds, and that opens the door for other issues, strategic issues for the Russians, gas and oil, the reconstruction, anything, establishing a Russian foothold in the broader region. Re-Iran, the interest between the Russians and the Iranians are a bit easier to define in that both have complemented each other in supporting the Assad regime. The Assad military has been barely functioning for a long time now, and the shock ground troops the Iranians have organized have been complemented by the Russian Air Force. So that's helped stabilize the country and prop up Bashar as nominally a president there. The relationship between the Iranians and the Turks is a bit trickier, but for now it's an alliance of convenience. They've come to an understanding that they will attempt to work in each other's interest to stabilize the north of the country and to take a stake in what emerges from the ruins of Syria.
That's the voice of Martin Chuloff, veteran correspondent from Beirut for The Guardian. Also with us on today's Media Roundtable is Martin Smith, award-winning journalist currently with Frontline. His most recent documentary is called Bitter Rivals. It's about Saudi Arabia and Iran, and it can now be viewed on the Frontline website. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today on the weekly Media Roundtable. We have two great journalists with us talking about a range of issues and events happening in the Middle East. We welcome your calls and questions about the coverage, what you have seen that's impressed you, if you've seen some reporting this week that helped you understand an important issue better. We invite you to share it. Or if you have questions for either of the Martins, we welcome you to give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I wanted to turn to something else that President Trump said, and that was that he said that if Saudi Arabia is interested in the U.S. staying in Syria, perhaps they should pay for it. Of course, this is in a long line of comments about who should pay for what that President Trump has made since before he was president. But, you know, this is close on the heels of the White House visit of Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and he, you know, the prince has gotten a lot of friendly coverage during his visit to the Europe and the U.S. over the past few weeks. Spent a lot of this week in Hollywood, and got a lot of very warm response there. And I was reading a piece in the Columbia Journalism Review about coverage of Saudi Arabia, and Steve Call, who's a longtime foreign correspondent, was saying that, you know, a lot of the coverage of Saudi Arabia is really top-down. And in the past, that's meant talking about how women can't drive and what that's meant for the, you know, certain kinds of restriction on elite people. And he's like, today you look at the coverage and it's basically royal family reform, women can drive. So kind of a flipping that. You've both covered Saudi Arabia for a long time. So I'm interested in your observations about coverage of the prince's visit and your reading of what he's trying to do right now. Martin Smith, let's talk with you first.
Well, it's been very positive and a successful trip. I would think he feels that. Look, he's on the one hand legitimately trying to change and quote-unquote reform Saudi society. This has been an effort that previous crown princes or kings have attempted. There's been a lot of pushback from what they call the religious street, the conservative Wahhabis who don't want change. So efforts in the past have failed, but he's bringing a lot of his young energy to this project. That's one side of the equation, and that's what got a lot of focus in the coverage of him. What doesn't get as much coverage is some of his policies. I'm sorry, that's the heating pipes in my building here.
It's okay.
Acting up. The war in Yemen, principal among them, has been a quagmire for him, and the amount of death and destruction that's been visited upon the Yemenis, the poorest country in the region, being bombed by a coalition of the wealthiest countries in the region, that got significantly less attention, and I'm sure that he liked it that way.
And Martin Chuloff, what did you observe?
I think Steve Cole's observations were very pertinent. There has been a lot of focus on proclamations from on high, partly with good reason, because the things that are being announced are significant. But I've spent a fair bit of time in Saudi in the last 6 months, and have tried to get amongst the people in the malls or in the mosques or in the cafes or on the streets, and just to test the mood there, because it's always been the understanding that the base in Saudi Arabia is more conservative than the leadership, and you know, I'm not sure that that stands. What we do see is a society there that certainly in you know, the modern areas of Riyadh, the well-to-do areas, are cautiously optimistic, but don't know how to embrace all of these things. There is so much going on at such a bewildering pace in a country where it's always been the mantra that it should be evolution, not revolution. But what we're seeing now is a cultural revolution in terms of it's a value shift, and people are being hit on a weekly basis with new announcements. It's you don't need to wear the abaya, you don't need to wear the hijab even, just dress respectfully, on and on it goes. Things that you wouldn't have imagined hearing in a lifetime in Saudi. There isn't, it must be said, a great deal of take-up at this point. And there does seem to be a residual pushback by state institutions where there are people who stand to lose a lot, who are still in power. And I do think that there may be some capacity to slow things down and for this change not to take place at the rapid pace that it's taking. But I guess that puts the onus on people like us to spend as much time as we can speaking to as many regular Saudis as we can, because proclamations are one thing, but outcomes are another. And I think it's going to make this part of the world particularly interesting in the next year or so.
We're going to have to go to a break in just a moment, but I wanted to get a quick thought from both of you. So, you know, the kind of narrative of, okay, here's, you know, there's the reformers, and then there's the kind of cultural conservatives, religious conservatives, that particular tension in Saudi Arabia. But from what you know of the country and talking to people there, are there any other fault lines that people from outside might not be as aware of, tensions within Saudi society? Martin Smith.
Well, they're of course in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. You have a large Shia population there that has been marginalized, but they are located where the oil is, where the wealth of the country is. There's been a fault line there for some time, all the way back in 1979 when there was an uprising there that was brutally put down by the regime. So there's a significant there's significant unhappiness. I visited there last year, and those people are not allowed to build mosques that they can worship in. They have what they call Husaniyas, which are a sort of a kind of mosque, but there's also in the major cities of Saudi Arabia, like Riyadh and Jeddah, it's forbidden for Shia in the country to have their own places of worship. There's also the division between the countryside and the cities. When we, as journalists, go in, a lot of us spend a lot of time, of course, in Riyadh, the capital, and in Jeddah. I think if you get out to some of the other parts of the country, such as Bereda, a bastion
Martin
of conservatism.
Smith. Martin, if you could just hold that thought for a moment, we are going to be right back after this break.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW, Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can email yourcall@klw.org or leave a comment on the website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, another roundup of the week's news with 1A and your host, Joshua Johnson from WAMU in Washington. And at noon, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is the Your Call Weekly Media Roundtable. Coming up on Monday, we're going to be talking to geophysicist Ronald Burgmann, who is at UC Berkeley, and talking about sea level rise, certainly for people in the Bay Area of great interest. Coming up next week, other programs as well. We're always interested in hearing from you. If you have ideas of shows you want to hear, send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. On today's Media Roundtable, I'm joined by a couple of veteran Middle East correspondents, Martin Smith of Frontline, Martin Chuloff of The Guardian, and we are talking about a range of subjects in the news this week around the Middle East, and we welcome your calls at 866-798-8255 or email at yourcall@kalw.org. Martin Smith, I'm sorry I had to cut you off in the middle of your response there about the division between urban Saudi Arabia and the countryside. So if you want to finish that thought, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just quickly, that there is a great division, as there are in most countries, between the cosmopolitan cultures of the capital and other major cities and the countryside. And I think there's been significantly less coverage of what Saudis in the countryside are feeling about the reforms that Mohammed bin Salman is putting into place.
I want to take our first caller, Phil in New Mexico. Phil, welcome to the Your Call Media Roundtable.
Thank you, Matt. I'd like to ask both correspondents to comment on their thoughts on the triple alliance that seems to have formed between Jared Kushner, Mohammed bin Sultan, and Benjamin Netanyahu, and whether or not we could be looking at the grand Sunni-Shia war that has been beckoning really since 1979, with the Israelis attacking the Shias in Hezbollah in Lebanon and Syria, and the Saudis and the Gulf Arabs attacking the Iranian Shia interests in the Gulf.
Phil, we got a really tough phone line with you there, so I'm going to cut you off, but I think we got your question, which is about Jared Kushner, the Trump administration, allying itself with both Israel and Saudi Arabia, and what that might mean for kind of the larger conflict, as he's describing it, between Shiites and Sunnis in the Middle East. Martin Chuloff, you want to bite that off a bit?
Yeah, well, the alliance between Kushner and MBS in particular has been fascinating. There's no doubt that both 30-somethings have spent a lot of time together talking big picture issues and in a young, almost impetuous way, thinking that they've got some of the answers to the region, including the big picture items, what to do about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and how to handle Iran. And now, that's brought the Israelis into the equation quite significantly, to the extent that the Israelis are also extremely hostile and wary of Iran, and perhaps as much as the Saudis are. So we're seeing an outreach there in ways that we haven't at any point since the State of Israel was formed. Kushner has been the mediator, but there's been a recent understanding is coming out of the Royal Court in Riyadh, and certainly this was hammered home to MBS when he was in New York and Washington, that it might not necessarily be in his best interest to link his destiny to Trump and Kushner. The talk about Jerusalem being taken off the table as a centerpiece of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict just should be set aside. I mean, there is no way that can be sold credibly to the region, least of all the Palestinians. So there was certainly talk about that earlier this year. It's an idea that Kushner had put forward, and we are told reliably that MBS had run with in private settings. But I'd be surprised if that went too much further, because there's been a strong pushback against that from almost every quarter of the region. He has been told very recently that that this is not a normal era in U.S. politics, that this conflation of personal ambition and pressure and the professional power that that the current White House uses is not normal, that this probably will not last, and to be linked so closely to both Trump and his son-in-law might not serve him well in the long term. So when he gets back to the region, it's going to be interesting to see if he projects himself in a different way if Kushner keeps getting invites to the Royal Diwan, because as the caller said, there has been a very significant move towards this troika of figures in the region who at one point had ambitions that they could perhaps help carve up some of the most intractable issues that have plagued the place.
Martin Smith, I want to get to talking about Yemen because you've done some amazing coverage there, and I want to make sure we get to that. But before we do, I do want to ask about this relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel. This week, the Crown Prince gave an interview where he kind of made some more friendly noises, not quite saying recognition of the Jewish state, but some things like you probably haven't heard from a Saudi leader before, that I think especially with the protests happening on the border between Gaza and Israel, the quite strong and deadly military response from the Israelis that coming at this time, it's been pretty controversial. What do you see happening in that relationship?
Well, I think this relationship is the result of a sense of desperation that developed during the Obama years, that they were being abandoned. And when Trump came along, he was willing to cozy up to that administration and all of its policies in the region, and that included these policies regarding the moving of the embassy and the support of Israel. He's feeling desperate because Saudi Arabia has been on a losing streak. They've lost their influence in Iraq, in Syria, long ago in Lebanon. They feel that with the arrival of Trump, they had somebody who would have their back. And so they've gone whole hog and cozied up to the Trump administration and to Kushner. I was surprised. I met with MBS last year, and I was surprised to the extent to which he had a sort of unquestioning faith that this was the way to go and had no sort of reservations about this being an unusual passage in American politics and that this was not a normal president. He was very enthusiastic. But this is because he feels seriously threatened by Iran and has for years and wants very much to have a friend in the region in Trump as well as at this point in Israel.
Well, so Martin Smith, I want to turn to talking about the civil war in Yemen, which this week the United Nations said had become the world's greatest humanitarian crisis, which given what has happened in Syria is that is really saying a lot. You, as you mentioned earlier, you and your colleagues were the only American reporters to get into Houthi-controlled areas of Yemen this past year. Talk about what it meant for you to actually be on the ground in Yemen and how it changed your understanding of that conflict.
It probably didn't change my understanding of that conflict as much as it deepened it. To be there and to travel to the capital Sana'a and then up to the Houthi heartland of Sada'a and over to Hajja, one of the poorest provinces, and see people suffering from a cholera outbreak that was due to a complete collapse of infrastructure and a pollution of their water supplies, to see children that were malnourished, and to talk to the Houthi officials about what was going on and see the bomb damage from the Saudi campaign. It was something that had been outlined. There's a lot of Yemeni stringers on the ground who have been able to get their pictures out and report on this. But, you know, it takes a strong stomach to confront the amount of suffering that one sees there, and it wasn't a war, I think, that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, thought was going to last this long. I think that I talked to the foreign minister, Adel al-Jubeir, of Saudi Arabia about this, and he tried to deny that that they were bogged down there. He simply said, no, you've been involved in Afghanistan, and you've been involved in Iraq for many more years. But they feel it. They feel that this is not doing them any favors, and that's why they're preventing people from freely going into the country.
Well, that moment between you and him where you kind of asked, like, are you getting bogged down? And you turned around and said, well, the U.S. is certainly, you know, hey, the U.S. has been there longer. I just, in my mind, is like, well, looks like everyone's bogged down, right? It didn't seem like the greatest response in terms of changing minds about what's happening there. But I mean, one of the things that, you know, you cover in your documentary in Yemen is, you know, evidence of U.S. weapons being used by the Saudis in their bombing that's happening there. And, of course, part of MBS's visit was this press conference with President Trump where he's holding up the cardboard saying, here's the hundreds of billions of dollars of military equipment that the U.S. is going to be selling to Saudi Arabia. How should Americans, you know, reading about this and thinking about this, you know, being called Saudi Arabia's war, talk about the U.S. role?
Well, I think, you know, Yemenis are much more aware that there's a participation of the United States and the United Kingdom in supplying weapons to the coalition that is carrying out this military campaign. They're much more aware of it than citizens in the UK or in the United States. And, you know, we're talking about now in the U.S. selling more weapons to the Saudis. I'm not sure how many more they need. They've got stockpiles of weapons, perhaps even still a lot more cluster bombs, which Obama cut them off from more sales of cluster bombs. These things have been enormously destructive. I think what Americans need to understand is that they're involved. That American tax dollars are contributing in several ways to logistical support, to mid-air refueling of coalition jets that are carrying out these bombing campaigns.
That is Martin Smith, a longtime correspondent in the Middle East, now with Frontline, great new documentary that came out last month called Bitter Rivals, about the competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia for dominance in that region and the incredible humanitarian disasters that have resulted in Iraq, in Syria, and in Yemen ongoing now. Also with us, Martin Chuloff of The Guardian, and we have some folks on the line who called in to 866-798-8255. Let's take the first of them, Gene in Alameda. Gene, welcome to your call.
Hello?
Gene, you're on. Is this Gene or is this Harry?
It's Harry.
Harry, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes, good morning. I wanted to ask your journalists if what perception the Saudis, the Turks, and the Iranians have regarding their government's imperialism abroad, and if they're really aware of the effects, or if there's any sort of perception against it or movement against what they're doing, or open discussion.
So what do the people think about what the governments are doing? Martin Chuloff.
And Matt, could you just repeat the thrust of that question, please? I wasn't picking that up.
Yeah, well Harry, are you still with us? We lost Harry. Well, I know that part of what he was talking about was, you know, what do people in countries like Syria or in countries like Yemen, I think Syria was what he was talking about, think about the role that Saudis are playing, that the Saudis are playing there, or also, I mean, I would say the Iranians as well, what role outside forces are playing?
In Syria, it certainly very much depends on your vantage point. If those who are allied to the Assad regime, and there are many people in the country who have made the calculation that they are better served by the regime staying, what became of the opposition provided no viable alternative, and that the country needs to be put back together as soon as possible. There are lots of people who have come to that determination, and it would be fair to say that most of the Assad supporters that I know would be pointing a strong finger of blame towards Saudi Arabia for having played a role in providing weapons to opposition groups. The paradox is that the Saudis were providing the bulk of their assistance to the American-backed FSA in northwestern Syria, and that was in the form of guided anti-tank missiles or anti-armor missiles that were being used to great effect throughout 2014 and 15. These were weapons that the U.S. had sold to Saudi Arabia way back in the early 90s, and the Saudis had now given to members of the Syrian opposition that had been vetted by the CIA. The weapons were being smuggled in via Turkey, and they were taking a very heavy toll on Assad's aging armor. It came to September 2015, where the Iranians realized that Latakia and Tartus were, to the two coastal cities which were in Assad's hands, were at risk of falling, that they went to Moscow and went to her and said, "Look, we need help here. Assad needs help. We need to double down. We need to protect him." And that was the reason that the Russians did get involved a month later. And so then if you switch across to the other side, those who are against the Assad regime, they speak equally as strongly about the Iranian presence and the Iranian intervention, which has been instructive in winning back the country on the ground. It led to the fall of Aleppo. It certainly helped with the fall of Ghouta in recent weeks. And so but from both sides of the divide there's a very strong understanding that there has been a form of proxy war between the two bitter rivals, and the subject of Martin Smith's great documentary, that have played an extensive role in Syria and remain deeply embedded. The Iranians more so, it must be said. The Saudis have backed away. They're engaged elsewhere, but they're not so busy in Syria these days. But nonetheless, the legacy of those years, particularly 2014 and 15, remain.
Martin, we're talking to you in Beirut, and we got a message from a listener who wanted to know how Lebanon is dealing with all the refugees that have been coming in from Syria, you know, following on, obviously, Palestinian refugees, and, you know, the pressure that's put on Lebanon as a nation.
Well, this country has the capacity to absorb people in flight. There's still around 350,000 Palestinians who have been here for either 48 or 67. And even in the good years, there were at least 1 million Syrians who came across the border to work, construction workers, but they've stayed here and they've done well. They've worked on a bustling building industry in Beirut in particular. And the camps, to the extent that you can call them camps, in the Bekaa Valley and elsewhere, they remain pretty grim places. Luckily, the winter wasn't harsh this year, but there is food, there is shelter, there is enough structure to support them. And the country, has more or less absorbed an estimate of about 1 million refugees. But there is significant political pressure, which was first raised last summer, for the refugees to go home. And that was coming from Lebanese leaders at the same time as the Syrian leadership was saying that it's all good, you can all return, the country's going to be put back together, and there's a place for everybody. Now, that messaging was coming from Damascus, and it was being repeated here in Beirut. It must be said that that's gone away ever since, they have the Ghouta. There's been issues in Idlib. There have been even more internal displacements this year than there have been in recent years. So the sting in that rhetoric, the political rhetoric, isn't there, and which is just as well, because it was getting rather heated on the streets at one point. There was a residual resentment that remains, but I think there's a slightly more of an accommodation with the Syrians in the midst of the Lebanese than there had been in the past. And for that to remain that way, I think there needs to be some more responsible political messaging coming from the leadership here.
I got an email from Zia in San Rafael who wants to ask, I think in regards to our conversation about reform, revolution, whatever you want to call it, in Saudi Arabia, saying, haven't we seen a top-down revolution by a monarch before? Look at the fate of the Shah of Iran, despite the fact that Iranians were much more receptive. Martin Smith, how would you respond to that parallel?
Well, I mean, the Shah was chased from power. If he's referring to 1953, when the United States and the Brits and the United States reinstalled the Shah, that didn't set things up to go too well. I mean, that led to the revolution of 1979.
I'm reading into what Zia says, but I'm guessing there might be some suggestion that yes, this might not go well either.
Well, in the past, as I mentioned earlier, there have been attempts by the Saudi leadership, which is generally far more liberal or secular than the street, than especially in the rural areas, and certainly of the clerics. There have been attempts in the past. One famously led to an assassination of a king. Other attempts have been made over the years to liberalize Saudi society, and they have failed. That's not to say that this one will fail. We just don't know. He's bringing a lot of energy, and there's a lot of it's a very young population. Many of them in the urban areas anyway certainly want this. The problem is that having a sort of reform from top down is going to be difficult. You have to open up a society at the bottom level and allow free expression so that people can actually own the reforms and the change. If you're just allowing people in a paternalistic way to have their to have some things that they want, I'm not so sure it's going to succeed.
I wanted to follow up with you, Martin Chuloff, talking about reporting on Syria and reporting on the just devastating war there. And just, you know, you obviously, both of you, you're part of this group of people, relatively small foreign correspondents who go back again and again and are really covering what in this area has been conflict after conflict. What kind of impact does that have on reporters in their work and as individuals? What's your sense of and how that then changes the way you actually report?
I think the bottom line on that is it's exhausting. It absolutely is, but it's also necessary, and you know, it's a civic responsibility that I'm happy to discharge. I'm privileged to be telling one of the more complex stories in the world for more than 13 years now, and empowered to do so. And you know, we can never lose sight of the fact that at the end of the day, as grinding as it might be for somebody like me to go in and out of war zones, it's 100 times more grueling for the people that I'm reporting on or spending my time with. I'm but a witness to their suffering, and you know, I'm privileged to be able to chronicle some of the epic stories of the region. And the formula that we use is always to pick that simple, quintessential human story which speaks to the much broader narrative. So, you know, the workload itself is something that we can handle, we can manage. What I do struggle with is the post-truth age that we're in, where objective truth doesn't seem to matter as much as it used to. The narrative is prevailing, and you know, that the fact that social media has been so readily co-opted by vested interests, whether they be individuals with agendas or whether they be state sanctioned entities who can very easily twist narratives and establish so-called counter facts. In the old days when we used to go places and objectively and factually report, then that would have been regarded as more or less a rough draft of history. These days, every single assertion is open to contest, and it makes it difficult. It requires a lot of stamina. It requires a lot of backing from your organization, and it requires a fair bit of belief, a fair bit of self-belief. And at the end of the day, we still hope that truth or an approximation of it will prevail. The minute we surrender to narrative, where everything is relative, is when we lose as journalists.
Martin Smith, you want to follow on what Martin Chuloff had to say there?
Well, I think that it was a very eloquent, well said piece by Martin. I would agree 100%. I mean, I agree. This is a privilege to cover this and to be entrusted by my employers, Frontline, to do this work. Is an honor for me, but at the end of the day, and Martin would agree, it's not about us as reporters. It's about the people on the ground. We return to our homes and have aren't suffering as the people we're reporting on do. I would also agree that this sort of this post-truth, post-factual era we're in is entirely pernicious, in that we now have sort of 24/7 punditry, where people go on the television or the radio with seemingly to people that don't know a kind of authority about the region, many of them who have never been, who don't have experience on the ground, and people are left to wonder just what is going on, because you have all these pundits out there offering opinions and are not distinguishing that kind of coverage from people like Martin and others who are on the ground doing this full time.
I have time for one last question. I'll ask you both to be brief in response to this, but it came from a listener saying, given all the turmoil and the shifting alliances, with hawks taking key positions in Washington, do you feel there are prospects for greater conflict in the near future? And I think they're talking about John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, taking roles in the Trump administration. 30 seconds, Martin Shuloff.
I'm particularly worried about Bolton, and so is a lot of Washington. There's going to be a lot of pressure on winding back this Iran deal. If that happens, that's going to escalate tensions in Syria especially, but perhaps even more problematically in Lebanon. So watch this space with Iran.
And Martin Smith.
I'm worried, too. I'm worried about the ability of this administration to handle the true crisis in the region. And everybody that I know that I've spoken with thinks that this is going to get worse before it gets better. And it's going to take some deft diplomacy, which we don't have, to handle a real blow-up in the region.
Martin Smith, who you were just hearing from, is an award-winning veteran frontline correspondent and producer. His latest two-part series, Bitter Rivals, Iran and Saudi Arabia, charts a 40-year rivalry between those two countries. Incredible range of interviews and from-the-ground footage. I really strongly recommend it. You can find a link at our website, yourcallradio.org, or just go to the Frontline website. Martin, thank you so much for joining us today and for all your good work.
Thank you very much.
Truly appreciate it. And Martin Shuloff is a reporter with The Guardian. He's covered the Middle East for that paper since 2005, and he won the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 2015. Well-deserved. Martin, thank you so much for joining the program, as always.
It's a pleasure. You're welcome.
Wow. Learned a lot in that hour listening to those two journalists, and I thank you so much for joining us. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. And to listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, you can do that at the website. You can also find us on iTunes, where we welcome your review. Follow us on Twitter at yourcallradio.org and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Maliha Razazan was today's producer. Joshua Wilner is our social media producer. Lauren Schechter helped out in studio. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Thanks for joining us. I'm Matt Martin. It's Your Call.